I'm Jeff Horwich, and this is The Week from In the Loop. Now, what you're listening to right now is a special introduction just for podcast and online listeners. Today's episode of The Week is a little bit different than our standard format, and here's why. As it turns out, our show hits the airwaves of Minnesota Public Radio this week at essentially the exact moment 1 year ago when the 35W freeway bridge collapsed into the Mississippi River in Minneapolis. 6:06 p.m. on August 1st. Even if you're not from here, I'm sure you remember 13 people died, many more injured and emotionally traumatized by such a huge disaster. Suffice it to say, our show couldn't just pop on the air with our usual rah-rah theme. So we started things off a little bit differently for radio listeners. On the radio, we picked up the sound of bells tolling in the city, and then we moved on into the show. For the first chunk of it, we decided to focus on one bigger question around the bridge collapse. Specifically, how do we memorialize something like this? There is a committee of survivors and victims' families that is working on that question. They haven't decided anything yet, and they're not talking about the deliberations. So we turned to something of a memorial expert. He's a cultural geographer at the University of Colorado, and his name is Kenneth Foote. He studied memorials all over the country to find out how and why we build the ones we build. And I started out by asking Professor Foote who a memorial like this about the bridge disaster is really for.
Most memorials serve a number of different audiences. And of course, when there are small tragedies, say a car accident or maybe an individual homicide, oftentimes the memorials are really for the family. But as these events affect a broader audience, whether it's a city or a state, they're also serving as a way of conserving that memory for far larger groups. And of course, that's also one of the reasons sometimes these memorials are very contentious, because you have people seeing different messages in them.
Does it surprise you that 1 year later we're still deliberating the real basics of sort of what, where, you know, and how we're going to mark the bridge collapse?
No, in fact, having memorials arise in less than a year is relatively unusual. I think the missteps that oftentimes occur about these memorials is trying to rush the process. The more chance people have to think about the issues, to appreciate the loss and so forth, there is a greater chance that they will come up with a better idea for the memorial. And part of that is also involving different voices and groups in the discussions. The drama of the bridge collapse, and also the fact that it represents a broader issue within the United States about decaying infrastructure and so on, means that there are several different groups that probably will want to have some say in it.
We now have a new bridge, almost ready, in Minneapolis. Can the rebuilt bridge be considered a memorial in some sense?
Oh, absolutely. I can think of a number of school fires. I can think of a number of accidents and so forth where the replacement structure became the memorial.
But there are some questions that arise from that. You know, for most of us, the question might be, do we want to think about the tragedy when we are going over that bridge? And then for the survivors and the victims' families, who in this case are the ones who are coming up with the design for the memorial, they have said they don't want the memorial to be within view of the bridge. Does that surprise you?
It's a real interesting point about this, because the term memorial comes from Latin, the sense of a reminder. So memorials are reminders, they're warnings, and in many cases, people want to be reminded. But there are lots of cases where the family or other factors intervene, and people say, we really want to have some distance between where the victims are buried or where the memorial is. And that has arisen in other situations. There was a tremendous boating disaster in the East River in New York City, the General Slocum disaster, which was back around the turn of the 20th century. And even though that occurred in the East River, the main memorial for the victims was placed in Queens, in a cemetery in Queens. So in some cases, that sense of loss can mean that the survivors and the victims' families will want to have some distance between the site and the place where they commemorate the victims.
In the case of whatever memorial arises to honor and remember the bridge collapse, what are some of the lessons that you would think we would want to convey through that?
With an event like this, it is, of course, the loss of life that is primary. So I think that will be fundamental. But it's that secondary, it's the connotation, I think, that'll be more tricky, because it's hard to commemorate that sort of a collapse of a bridge. It's the representation of someone's fault, of something that wasn't cared for, that wasn't watched carefully. And that's a tricky idea. It's not a nuance of meaning that's oftentimes represented in monuments. That is, monuments are much more commonly tributes to people's accomplishments or sacrifices rather than to people's mistakes.
But it's also difficult to completely scrub, you know, from any implication that the site might have.
It is. And in the cases where I've seen these sorts of things, where people are looking at it in terms of blame or fault and so on, it tends to be retroactive. It's people coming back 40 years on or 50 years on and saying, this was a site where something happened. Now we know the causes and we've done things about it. But at the time, of course, the nerves are pretty raw. And so people don't want to have those kinds of messages thrust back in their faces.
Speaking with us from Boulder, Colorado, Professor Kenneth Foote, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Kenneth Foote is a cultural geographer at the University of Colorado. His most recent book is Shadowed Ground, America's Landscapes of Violence and Tragedy. You're listening to The Week from In the Loop. I am Jeff Horwich. In the U.S., we're fortunate we don't face this question of memorializing all that often. Naturally, officials and families in the case of the bridge collapse are taking some time to think it through. Other places in the world have considerably more experience with tragedies on this scale. Just this week alone, there have been bombings in India, Turkey, and Iraq. In the last case, a single bomb killed 56 people. In Israel, attacks have been a fact of life for decades, a symptom of the deep divisions between Arabs and Israelis. Whatever your views on the Middle East, there remains something universal about the violent manifestations of this tension. It's a community grappling with the sudden, large-scale loss of life. Andy David is with the Israeli Consulate to the Midwest, which is in Chicago. He's the Deputy Consul General there, and as we think about memorializing the bridge, we thought we'd turn to him for some insight. Mr. David, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Jeff, for inviting me.
Is there any sort of official practice for memorializing tragic events in Israel?
Well, we do have one official day for memorial. We call it Remembrance Day. On that day, we remember all those who've fallen when fighting for our freedom, and also memorializing or remembering victims of terror attacks.
How do you handle individual events, like, say, a bombing, or there have been some, like, bulldozer attacks in recent months?
Yeah, well, there's no official memorials for those kind of events. It could be the city, it could be the town, could be the family members of those who lost their life, who would decide to do something, a plaque, you know, on the side of a building or on a wall, a small garden or something of the sort.
Do Israelis still pause when they pass a memorial on the street?
On a regular day, I would say no. You know, if there was a coffee shop, for instance, who was bombed. Okay, so there might be a little plaque on one of the corners of that coffee shop. Okay, so people come there not to remember the terrorists. They come for coffee. You know, people live their lives. People of Israel live. One thing that we're trying not to do in Israel is to idolize death. We idolize life.
Does that translate into sort of not over-memorializing, keeping things relatively modest?
I think you're right. Clearing the scene as quick as possible, maybe leaving behind as a local initiative some kind of a symbol, modest symbol, that's basically it. And the rest is just trying to continue to build our lives and to live in peace.
Now, a terrorist attack in Israel and our bridge disaster here are similar in the sense that there is a certain unpredictability about it. And they're quite different, of course, because of the political implications of it. But given that we here are still contemplating how to memorialize our particular disaster, I wonder if there's anything that you think we can learn from the Israeli experience.
Well, it's a bit difficult for me to try to draw conclusions because, you know, a collapse of a bridge is an accident. It's a very visual one because it's a huge bridge who collapsed. I remember that day clearly.
And the image of that creates a certain amount of fear going forward, I suppose, which is comparable.
Yeah, people feel that, you know, they were riding their cars and suddenly, you know, things collapse under them. maybe if I am in a position to give advice, which I don't think I am, I would say that not to glorify the death. You know, that was a terrible tragedy. We will do whatever we can to prevent that tragedy from happening again. We'll take all the necessary steps. But that we do because we glorify life.
And I imagine rebuilding the bridge essentially within a year would very much fall within kind of the Israeli philosophy for this type of thing.
Life goes on.
Well, Andy David, Deputy Consul General for the Israeli Consulate to the Midwest, thank you very much for giving us a few minutes today.
Thank you very much, Jeff. Thank you.
You're listening to The Week. I'm Jeff Horwich. So far on the show, we've been considering the notion of large-scale memorials, memorials for the whole community. But a memorial can also be a very personal act. In the case of the 35W bridge collapse, we ran across one personal method that surprised us a little bit, but maybe it shouldn't have.
My name is Kyle Malone. I'm a tattoo artist at Trust Fate Tattoo. Immediately afterwards, within that first month there, I'd say, you know, last August and September, there was a buzz, no pun intended, about the 35W tattoos and whatnot. I did a 35W commemorative tattoo for a gentleman who had a loved one lost in the bridge collapse last year. It was basically the 35W logo, just the road sign that we all see. It was rendered in black and gray. I think he went with black and gray as more of a mourning sign instead of putting color in it. And we said that at some point, if he ever wanted to go ahead and put color in it, once he'd gotten through the mourning process and whatnot, then he could come back and put color in it. Commemorative tattoos are very common. I think it's more as not necessarily remembering the negativity. I think it's more of a way to find healing, you know, and be able to find closure on something. No matter what the tragedy, a bridge collapse or, you know, a bombing, and you know, it doesn't matter what it was. Anytime there's lives that are lost, you need to never forget that. Tattoo's permanent, so you literally can never forget. Once it's on your skin, it's always there. You know, they'll wake up every morning and look at that tattoo, and they'll remember the life that was lost. And with the gentleman that I tattooed with the 35W bridge, he wanted to wake up every day and have a constant reminder of what that meant to him personally, being the fact that he lost somebody in the bridge. And to me, I think that's what it really symbolizes.
That was Kyle Malone. He's a tattoo artist at Trust Fate Tattoos here in St. Paul. Our producer, Sandon Totten, went out and talked to him. I am Jeff Horwich, and this is The Week from In the Loop. In the time we've got left here, we're going to move away from the bridge collapse, and let's talk for a minute about the economy. This week, we learned the U.S. economy actually shrank at the end of last year, and even the stimulus checks didn't give us much of a boost this spring. Despite it all, though, consumer confidence actually ticked up a little bit. So apparently we're either optimistic in a plucky American kind of way, or we are blissfully ignorant of things. As it turns out, tightening the belt is the theme of our most recent In the Loop Story Slam. And as a matter of fact, that Story Slam in all its hour-long glory will be on the air and podcast this coming Sunday evening. So I want to give you just a bit of a preview now. We had lots of great storytellers join us at the Bedlam Theater the other night in Minneapolis to take a stab at our theme, tightening the belt. Among them, Vicky Joan Keck.
I do like my job. I enjoy the work. My coworkers, it's fairly low stress, good hours, good benefits, but the pay is fairly mediocre. And it's getting harder and harder to make ends meet. I cut back wherever I can, and when my mechanic told me last February that Francis, my beloved 1997 Chevy Lumina, needed $1,500 worth of work done, I had to think about that long and hard. Did I really want to put that kind of money on my credit card, or should I just bite the bullet and get rid of that car? So in April, I got what I could for dear old Francis and joined up with one of those car sharing programs for when I really need the wheels. For the most part, it's all good, but there is a learning curve when getting used to relying on the mass transit. It always takes 2 or 3 times longer than I think it will to get anywhere these days. And I have a hard time giving up the independence that I used to have. Riding the bus, however, I am discovering is always an adventure. On one particular hot, sticky, crowded day on the bus, I wrote this slam, which I call my mass transportation lamentation. I am sitting at the station with frustration and trepidation that I am late to my destination. I need fortification to deal with the degradation of this kind of transportation where the air is just full of perspiration, and I have the inclination that half the population should be in some kind of incarceration when every exclamation is an expletive. Oy vey, I do a silent invocation for the salvation from this infiltration of abomination and intoxication. So please forgive my exasperation, but I'd love an explanation for your hesitation to understand my situation. In summation, I need a vacation.
All right, that was storyteller Vicki Joan Keck joining me on the stage of our most recent In the Loop Story Slam. The theme, tightening the belt. You can listen to the full hour-long Story Slam Sunday night at 6 on the stations of Minnesota Public Radio News. And of course, you can get the podcast, listen to it online at minnesotapublicradio.org. Just look for the In the Loop homepage. And let me just quickly mention, we've got a Story Slam coming up at the Minnesota State Fair on Saturday, August 23rd. More details about that also at our website. Now, before we end the show, we're going to mark an anniversary. It was 20 years ago this day, August 1st, 1988, that Rush Limbaugh's radio show first hit the airwaves. We were listening in today, as we so often are, and of course, Rush could not let the occasion go unmarked.
Your guiding light, Rush Limbaugh, serving humanity simply by showing up. It's Open Line Friday and a 20th anniversary of the Excellence in Broadcasting Network. Remember, we had
modesty, of course, not one of Rush Limbaugh's strengths, but you know, modesty doesn't keep you on the air for 20 years, so there you go.
The President of the United States, George W. Bush, in fact, took a few minutes from his busy day to call into the Rush Limbaugh show and wish him well.
I'm just calling along with President 41 and the former governor of Florida. We're fixing to have lunch here, and I said, listen, we ought to call our pal and let him know, that we care for you.
Thank you, sir, very much. I'm overwhelmed. I can't tell you how much I appreciate this and how much you surprised me.
Curtis Gilbert is a reporter here at Minnesota Public Radio who is thinking about all things politics these days, but in particular this week was thinking about Rush Limbaugh's anniversary. Curtis, thanks for coming in.
It's my pleasure, Jeff.
So there are a lot of right-wing radio hosts out there. Sean Hannity comes to mind. Why should we go out of our way to mark Rush Limbaugh's anniversary?
Well, he is the biggest, loudest, and arguably most influential voice in right-wing talk radio and talk radio in general. His show has been rated number one for as long as they've had ratings. He has 14 million listeners every single week. And it's clear that he's worth a lot of money to his advertisers. He just signed a brand new contract for $50 million a year for the next 8 years. So Rush is a big deal.
That sounds like an awful lot to make radio. Take it from us. And you found a local businessman who was very early to the Rush Limbaugh trend and capitalized on that. Who's this guy?
Well, Rick Casper owns Casper's Cherokee Sirloin Room. They have two locations in Eagan and West St. Paul.
Red meat kind of place.
Absolutely. Yeah. And he noticed, it was the early 90s, and he noticed something happening at the Eagan location.
The popularity of Rush was just starting to mushroom. And a lot of my regular customers would come in and actually they'd bring their radio in from their car or from wherever, sit down, have lunch, and listen.
And his customers kept bothering him to just put the show on the loudspeaker so they wouldn't have to keep on bringing their own radios into the bar. So he started doing it. They called it the Rush Room, and it actually got written up in the local paper.
And lo and behold, you know, then other, I guess, Rush holics, I don't know what you call them, came out, and it probably grew to around maybe 50 people, you know, that came in specifically at lunchtime to listen to Rush.
And Casper's kept on doing the Rush Room for 2 whole years.
Well, if that's bringing in 50 people a day, why would you stop?
Well, Rick Casper says there are lots of fads in the bar business that kind of come and go. They're a way to bring in people, and eventually people get tired of it. He actually started getting tired of it himself, and it was causing some problems.
Being in a restaurant, you sort of like to be on both sides. You don't like to... I don't like to be a Democrat. I don't like to be a Republican. I like to be both, you know. I support everybody. But some people on principle then would say, well, you got a rush room. I don't think I want to come to your restaurant. That's another reason probably why we stopped doing it, too.
Okay, very interesting. So even though he draws a big crowd, even at the Cherokee Sirloin Room, they eventually realize there are a lot of people that can't stand him and needed to shut the thing down.
Right. Well, they might have shut it down there, and that was only the mid-90s. But Rush's influence has, if anything, grown since then, and not just in the world of broadcasting like we were talking about a few minutes ago, but politics too. I mean, just during this most recent Democratic primary, Rush was running this thing called Operation Chaos, where he was encouraging his conservative listeners to go out and vote in Democratic primaries to try and prolong that battle between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama as long as possible. It's hard to say exactly how effective that was, but some pretty influential people, from John Kerry to Karl Rove, thought it might have had an effect.
Well, if you look at the facts on the ground, you know, if Rush was trying to mess up the eventual Democratic nominee, looks like Obama's doing okay for himself at the moment, and maybe McCain failed to capitalize on that. But he's got 20 years of experience, that Rush, and the election's not over, right?
That's right, and Rush Limbaugh has made it perfectly clear he intends to do plenty more between now and Election Day to trip up Obama and the Democrats.
Don't underestimate Rush Limbaugh. Curtis Gilbert, thanks a lot.
My pleasure, Jeff.
Curtis is a reporter for Minnesota Public Radio News, and he co-hosts a fun podcast called Election Wise that sets out each week to answer your election-related questions. You can find it at minnesotapublicradio.org. The Week from In the Loop is produced by Sandon Totten and me. We're edited by Kate Smith. Special help this week from Whitney Stark, Srini Radhakrishna, and Bill Wareham. Our theme and much of our other music, including what you're hearing right now, is by The Smarts. Learn more about them and more about us at minnesotapublicradio.org. Just look for In the Loop in the programs menu. You can podcast the show, keep up with the blog, and we'd love for you to join us on Facebook. We'll be back to our usual hijinks again next week. Same time, same station. And until then, I'm Jeff Horwich.